use, and of those, a measurable percentage lost their fingers, eyes, or lives when the weapons burst from the inside, rather than propelling their loads toward the target. Any given pistol could fire only 50 or 60 rounds before the corrosive fire powder began to eat through the copper plating within the barrel, at which point iron rot would set into the steel, weakening the gun until an inevitable misfire occurred. Grimm had dutifully gone through half a dozen barrels while learning to fire the weapon with a modicum of proficiency. But he was by no means an expert, so he strode toward Cavendish as rapidly as he could, to fire from a distance that would preclude a miss due to his dubious competence. Once she was dispatched, he could discard the pistol and bring his gauntlet to bear on the silkweavers rushing up behind her. Silkweavers? God in heaven, there were dozens of the deadly, fully grown adult surface creatures pouring out of one of the tunnels, rushing toward his men. With the arrival of sudden terror, the timeless moment of detached observation ended. Bridget! Benedict shouted. Sark came to his feet, his blade darting toward the downed girl, but Benedict let out a lion's roar of pure fury, a sound that shocked Grimm's senses, and hit Sark in a flying tackle. Both warrior-born went down, struggling against each other. The roar seemed to galvanize Madame Cavendish. She looked up, blinking her eyes, and they widened when they locked onto Grimm. She began to rise to her feet. He wished he were closer to the Etherealist, but this distance, 7 or 8 yards, would have to be close enough. Her hand was already rising toward him, and he had only a single instant to act. Grimm corrected his aim slightly and squeezed the trigger. The pistol sparked and then spoke, a flash of bright light in the dim chamber. Madame Cavendish let out a sudden, breathless cry and spun violently in place, hurled back to the ground again as though struck with a club. The first of the silkweavers flung itself through the air toward Grimm, letting out a shrieking cry that sent another bolt of terror through him, for he had heard it before, only days ago in the dark ventilation tunnels of Habel Morning, when he had fought back to back with Alex Bayard. There was no time to prime the gauntlet. Instead, he flipped the pistol, gripped it by the barrel, and brought the handle of the heavy, primitive weapon down upon the head of the silkweaver with every ounce of strength he could muster. His arm screamed with pain, muscles and tendons protesting the abuse, but they functioned. The blow clubbed the silkweaver to the floor, and Grimm wasted no time in driving his short, shipboard blade down into the silkweaver's body, where its head met its neck. He barely managed to jerk the blade clear before the beast went into wild spasms, all its legs flailing with no semblance of cohesion, its three-jawed muzzle snapping wildly, bubbling with venomous foam. The aeronauts of Predator let loose a battle cry of their own, screaming, "Albion!" And then the battle was joined. There was no time to think, to issue orders, or to do anything but survive. Gauntlets discharged. Silkweavers shrieked. Grimm dodged the pounce of another silkweaver by the barest margin, and he caught a glimpse of Madame Cavendish on the floor, her face deathly pale, pointing a finger at Grimm and wailing in primal outrage. And half a dozen of the monsters darted toward him, following her command. Grimm would have died where he stood if Kettle, Creedy, Stern, and half a dozen other aeronauts hadn't reached his side, their gauntlets howling. They blew two of the silkweavers into bloody, stinking meat, but a third darted beneath the blasts, seized the wiry Stern by one leg, and hauled him from his feet with abrupt violence, fangs sinking, tearing, and bubbling with poison. Stern screamed. Grimm struggled to get to the downed man, but it was all he could do to fend off another monster and prevent himself from joining Stern on the ground. He slashed and scored a pair of solid strokes, but the silkweaver's leathery hide was tough, and the blows drew little blood. Stern's leg broke with an audible crack, and blood began streaming from the wound. The scent of the blood washed over the silk weavers like a sudden wind born of primal, insane violence. Their shrieks rose up again, deafening, and Grimm felt his legs go watery. Their movements became quicker, more erratic, and the venom practically frothed from their jaws, pattering onto the spirestone floor. With the silk weavers maddened by blood, there were now only two outcomes possible in the current situation. Either Grimm and the men of Predator would destroy every single silk weaver present, or else they would fall to the jaws and venom of the surface creatures. Stern screamed again, drawing a belt knife and stabbing down at the silk weaver holding on to his leg, but the creature shook him like a cat shaking a tunnel mouse, too strong for its size, slamming the young man left and right and sending the knife tumbling. On Grimm's other side, Creedy drove the heel of his boot into a silk weaver's mouth, only to have the thing lock its jaws onto Creedy's foot and wrench at the Exo's leg. Its teeth sliced through the leather of Creedy's boot, and he shouted in rage and pain. Kettle's boarding axe came sweeping down on the silk weaver and split the thing in half in the middle of its body. But the dying front half kept wrenching and rending Creedy's foot nonetheless. More of the damned creatures were coming, scuttling over the walls and the ceiling, using their superior mobility to surround Grimm and his men. Grimm's ground combat experience was limited, but it was not difficult to deduce that they had only moments to live. And then Felix and the Verminositors entered the fray. They uttered no battle cry, and made no sound as they came rushing in from each of the open tunnels leading to the Auroran encampment. But as they closed the distance to the nearest silk weavers, their scale lashes began to whirl, building momentum and emitting soft, hissing whistles as they spun. The scale lash was a deadly instrument. Made of small rings of metal knitted into a tapered tube, each ring hung with a pointed, edged metal scale. The bloody things weighed as much as an axe, and hit with nearly as much force. And then the scales ripped away chunks of flesh as they tore free. A strike with a scale lash could saw its way through the toughest hide, inflicting deep, horribly painful bleeding wounds. What they did to soft human flesh was indescribable. A dozen of the weapons whipped toward the rearmost rank of silk weavers in a unified chorus of violence. Verminositors prowled the darkness of the tunnels of every habble in the spire. On a daily basis they faced the possibility that they might find themselves face to face with a nightmare from the surface world. It was a necessary duty. Without Verminositors, horrors from the surface could and would emerge from the ventilation and service tunnels and begin preying upon citizens of the habble, and their first victims were very nearly always children. Men and women who took up that responsibility were, by definition, confident, skilled, fearless, and mildly insane. And, Grimm thought, this particular pack of madmen had a score to settle. Scale lashes hammered and tore. Silk weavers screamed. Some of Felix's people had exchanged short, heavy spears for their lashes, and when one of their compatriots wounded or stunned a silk weaver, a spear carrier would rush in and deliver the death stroke from the relative safety of the longer weapon's reach. Felix himself whirled a scale lash in either hand, striking left and right, smashing armor, ripping flesh, and severing the beast's legs with a kind of dreadfully workaday practicality. With a quick motion, he struck the silk weaver attacking Grimm, a savage blow that drove it flat to the ground, stunned. Then he dropped one lash, flicked the other around the neck of the silk weaver, wrenching at Stern's leg, and twisted the metal weapon with professional expertise, tightening it around the creature's head. The silk weaver began to thrash wildly, but Felix simply settled his weight onto it more firmly and held on, leaning into the strength of the pull until the creature's triple jaws snapped open and it let out a shriek of pain. Grimm dispatched the silk weaver Felix had stunned, then stepped around behind the Verminositor. He murmured, "Excuse me," set his weapon carefully, and drove his sword into the same spot at the base of the silk weaver's skull. The thing went mad for a few seconds, thrashing wildly, and then simply sagged like a bladder being drained of its liquid. Felix unwound his lash from the dead silk weaver.
"You boys aren't bad. For a bunch of rubbernecks, I mean."
"Thank you," Grimm said hesitantly.
"Mr. Creedy."
"Sir."
"Get Stern and yourself to Dr. Bagan."
Grimm turned back to Felix.
"What, sir, is a rubberneck?"
Felix flashed Grimm a quick grin.
"We'll get this work done, and I'll tell..."
The Verminositor turned abruptly, his eyes widening, and Grimm followed the man's gaze to one of the other tunnels leading into the intersection the Aurorans had claimed. There was a chorus of shrieks, and a second group of silk weavers, as large as the first, poured into the intersection. Grimm watched helplessly, shouting a warning that went unheard as half a dozen of the Verminositors were buried under a wave of ripping jaws and poisoned fangs, overwhelmed by the sudden onslaught. Their screams of terror swiftly became gargling sounds of despair, and then fell silent. Next in the path of the second group of horrors were the two Warriorborn. Benedict had gained the upper hand on Sark as the two wrestled, and was more or less on top, his arms and hands moving so quickly that Grimm could hardly see them, while Sark matched him motion for motion, countering every move the younger man attempted. As the fresh tide of silk weavers rushed toward them, the two Warriorborn snapped their gazes up toward the oncoming wave. Benedict's eyes widened, and he began to hurl himself away from Sark, but the evil-looking Warriorborn locked a leg around Benedict's legs and fastened his hands on Benedict's jacket. With an ugly smile, he twisted, rolling Benedict toward the silk weavers. Benedict reversed his direction almost instantly, and instead of trying to escape Sark, he went with his opponent, twisting his own body in the same direction. He hit the ground on his back and rolled Sark over him, hurling the larger Warriorborn a couple of feet clear of him and into the first rank of silk weavers. The creatures flowed over Sark like some kind of horrible, living blanket, and he vanished from sight. Benedict barely regained his feet before the first half-dozen silk weavers reached him. Had Grimm been standing in the young man's shoes, he felt sure he would not have survived. But then he was not Warriorborn. Benedict let out a leonine roar, dodged the first silk weaver, and swept his sword from its sheath to cut another one cleanly in half as it flew toward him. One hit his arm and clamped its tripartite jaws down on his biceps. Benedict staggered, converted the momentum of the creature's leap into a spin, and slammed it into two of its fellows as if the silk weaver had been a shield strapped to his arm, knocking them aside. The sixth silk weaver hit Benedict at the knees and sank its teeth into his thigh, knocking him down violently.
"Back to back," Grimm bellowed to his men. "Group up! Kettle, on me!"
He strode toward Benedict, priming his gauntlet as he went, unleashing blast after blast into the oncoming mass of silk weavers, smashing two of them to flaming pulp and buying Benedict a few precious seconds. The Warriorborn managed to kick free of the silk weaver latched onto his leg and, with a scream of fury and pain, lifted his arm and smashed the silk weaver holding onto it into the spirestone floor repeatedly until purplish ichor splattered and the thing fell off, body curling, legs twitching spasmodically. Grimm and Kettle reached Benedict's side. Kettle laid about with his axe, keeping the silk weavers at bay. Grimm hauled Benedict to his feet by main force, fending off another silk weaver with his sword as he did.
"Bridget and Folly!"
Benedict cried. He was bleeding freely from both his arm and his leg, but there was no time to dress the wounds. The enemy was already struggling to overwhelm them.
"We have to get them out!"
"Stay together," Grimm replied. "Follow me!"
He raised his gauntlet and began blasting the spirestone floor in the general direction of where he'd last seen Bridget lying on the ground. He hit nothing, but a handful of silk weavers that had begun approaching from that direction skittered back several feet. Grim walked into the cleared space and blasted the floor again, sweeping more silk weavers from his path, and continued walking. He heard Kettle doing the same behind him, blasting away with his gauntlet to keep the main body of silk weavers back. He had a severe fright when a silk weaver dropped from the ceiling overhead toward his skull, but Benedict jerked Grim aside with one hand, and with the other neatly skewered the silk weaver on his sword, holding the creature aloft for a moment as it thrashed, his arm steady, before he flung it off of his blade, twisting it as it came free of the silk weaver's body. The creature gushed foul-smelling blood as it tumbled away. Grim continued, and only barely stopped himself from unleashing a blast from his rapidly heating gauntlet that would have struck the prone form of Bridget Targwyn.
"Form a circle around her!"
he barked. He sheathed his sword as the men closed around them, and bent down to pick her up. She was a tall young woman, and heavier than she looked. Grim got one of his shoulders beneath one of her arms and leveraged her to her feet. She blinked several times, her eyes not quite focused, but though her legs wobbled, she was able to support most of her own weight.
"Miss Targwyn," Grim shouted over the howl of discharging gauntlets, "where is Miss Folly?"
Bridget stared at him, blinking several times. Then she said,
"Tunnel. In the tunnel. Lying on the floor."
Grim's stomach twisted in sickened horror.
"Which one?"
Bridget stared around her for a moment, and then nodded down the tunnel Grim hadn't ordered blown halfway to hell.
"Captain!"
Kettle screamed, his voice a warning. Grim's head snapped around, and his belly tightened and writhed still more as he realized the depth of their predicament. The surprise assault of the Verminositors had been itself taken by surprise by the second wave of silk weavers. Men and women lay dying or dead, and more were being killed in front of Grim's eyes. The stench of blood and entrails had already filled the air, mixing with the foulness of silk weaver blood. Several members of his crew were down, and others were fighting a desperate retreat back the way they had come, and he could see what had made the sudden reversal possible. Sark was among them. The large warrior-born moved with terrible speed, darting here and there, never predictable, moving among the silk weavers as if he were one of their number. As Grim watched, Sark crushed a woman's throat with a casual squeeze of his hand, and hamstrung another Verminositor, dropping him to the ground, where the silk weavers could finish him. His hand moved, and a knife flickered through the air and plunged into the leg of Henderson, Kettle's apprentice pilot. The young man screamed and clutched at his leg as he fell. Grim tried to shout, to order Henderson not to remove the knife, but the young man jerked it clear in a small spray of blood, and every silk weaver within 30 feet flung itself upon him until he was buried under a mound of ripping, worrying bodies, and more blood scattered through the air. Michaels, a gunner's mate on the number 5 gun, raised a gauntlet and discharged it twice, aiming at Sark. The first blast missed, the second whipped out and around Sark in a tight orbit, then flew back into Michael's head, slamming home with explosive violence, hurling a nearly faceless corpse to the spire-stone floor. Grimm's eyes darted to one side, where Madame Cavendish stood, one hand pressed against her ribs over a fresh, wet bloodstain on her dress. The other was extended toward Sark, and her eyes were gleaming. The crew was being driven back down the breach they'd made with the blasting charges, and the silk weavers that had been finishing the last of the disabled Verminositors began to gather, darting toward Grim and his little band in swift, agitated motions. They were cut off.
"Fall back!" Grim shouted. "Back down the tunnel! Keep them off with gauntlet fire until we get a defensive position!"
They retreated, step by step. The copper cages of their gauntlets were smoking and smouldering with heat. Creedy's teeth were clenched over a rising, screaming sound, but the tall young XO kept blasting away with his gauntlet in steady rhythm. They made it to the tunnel, and Bridget slid off of Grimm's shoulder and half fell down beside Miss Folly, who lay on the floor, curled up into a fetal position, quivering as though her muscles were trying to curl up even tighter. Grimm looked around. The tunnel had been blocked with more masonry, just as had the one they'd entered through. There was no way out of it, and no time to build even a meager defense out of the mound of stone. A voice suddenly called from the tunnel beyond. Madame Cavendish.
"This is the third time you've interfered with my business, Captain,"
she said, her words hard-edged, cold.
"And as you have spilled my blood, it shall be the last."
"Madame, call off your pets," Grimm called at once. "Guarantee the safe conduct of those with me, and I'll surrender. You can kill me however you like."
"I can do that without your cooperation, thank you,"
Madame Cavendish replied, her tone amused.
"Goodbye, Captain."
And with that, a horde of silk weavers poured through the mouth of the tunnel. Too many of the things. They were running along the walls and ceilings, spread out, moving too fast, in numbers too many to be counted. Grimm and his people were about to be overwhelmed, and there was not a thing he could do to stop it.
Chapter 54. Elsewhere.
Folly had time to see Madame Puppet point a finger at her, and to feel a geyser of etheric energy smash into her body. Then an entire spire full of pain crashed down upon her. Folly thought she must surely have screamed. She knew nothing except agony, and every sensation only seemed to magnify it more. She felt herself fall, curling up into a ball, felt her eyes squeezing shut as every muscle in her body convulsed at once. She couldn't hear anything through the discordant howling sound in her head, and her throat didn't hurt, not with this new definition of pain, but it tickled a little. It seemed reasonable to assume that she must have been screaming. That thought triggered another. How odd it was that she should have the wherewithal to process such a thought when her nervous system was so utterly overwhelmed. And that thought led to still another. How odd that she should be aware enough to notice her thought process at all. She was still aware of the pain. Pain so great that she would have welcomed the dubious relief of emptying her stomach onto the floor, if only for a change of pace. Simultaneously, she could feel her thoughts drifting free of her body's limits. Like a length of ether silk snapped from a ship's web floating away upon the etheric currents. Her body, her senses, all remained upon the floor of the blockaded tunnel, but her thoughts weren't there with them. Her mind was somewhere else entirely. She was elsewhere. For a moment, she floated in an empty void. And then she became conscious of solid ground beneath her feet. She looked down at it curiously and found it strange. She knelt to examine it more closely. The ground was not spire stone. It was loose earth, pale and granular. She pinched a bit up in her fingers and examined it. The earth was heavily mixed with sand. Earth. Sand. Was she standing upon the surface? The thrill of sudden terror that went through her was entirely unnecessary, unfair, and impolite, Folly felt. She knew, after all, that her body was being torn apart with pain back in Spire Albion. But nonetheless, she had spent her entire lifetime in curiosity and utter dread about the true nature of the surface world outside the spires, the land of nightmares made flesh. In all of written history, the surface world had been a hell braved only by the mad, the desperate, and the madly, desperately greedy. Though her mind contradicted her fear, it seemed her body had an opinion of its own, and her heart raced. She rose
and turned in a slow circle. The mists were thin here, and she could see at least 100 feet, but her cursory survey revealed nothing but more flat, dry earth and a few scattered stones. Then the ground shook. It rumbled and quivered, and she could feel an impact through the soles of her feet. The sound came again, and then again, louder each time. Footsteps. Enormous footsteps. Coming closer. The mists stirred, and something vast and slow and seething with hate stopped just out of sight, so that all Folly could see was a great dark blur. She froze in place and covered her mouth with her hands to hide the sound of her breathing. And then a great voice filled the air, resonant and mellifluous, like that of a particularly eloquent, poised, mature man, a professional speaker.
"Report."
Folly hesitated. Whatever was happening to her, it seemed likely that it had not placed her in a position of leverage and power. But at the same time, her body was dying in any case. She could feel her straining heart racing so fast that she could not count individual beats. There seemed little enough point in prudence. And besides, she was curious. She had questions. And answering questions was very nearly always more important than caution. Even the act of asking a question would tell her more than she now knew. If she could indeed ask it, there was no way to know but to try. So she lowered her hands and said,
"I beg your pardon. Whatever do you mean?"
She felt a sudden, awful attention from the thing in the mists, and the voice said again,
"Report."
"I hardly knew what you meant the first time. I've not gained an epiphany of insight in the past 5 seconds, I assure you."
There was a flash of red light somewhere in the fog, high above Folly's head, burning from 3 separate sources. "Eyes?"
"You," the voice said. "You are not Cavendish."
"Madame Puppet?"
Folly asked.
"Indeed not, and I thank you for the compliment."
"Identify yourself."
Folly bobbed a quick curtsy toward the monstrous figure and said,
"Folly, who are you?"
The voice did not answer.
Instead, there was an enormous boom of sound, like some utterly monstrous airship's steam-powered horn blaring out into the night. A moment of silence went by, and then the call was answered from far away, with more horn-blast sounds.
"You are a potential asset."
"For you?"
Folly asked.
"I do not think so. I'm not a puppet. You said so yourself."
"Yield."
The 3 red lights flared brighter, and Folly was suddenly subsumed in a horrible, ugly pressure she felt inadequate to describe. It was an enormous amount of power, one that quite took her breath away. She could feel it scraping at her thoughts, raking them with claws, seeking something it could seize and use to hang on. It sought to control her, just as she might control a...
"I see,"
Folly murmured.
"You're the one holding the puppet's strings, aren't you? You're the one holding all the puppet's strings."
"Yield,"
the voice thundered. The pressure increased, but Folly could feel it sliding off of her, left and right, and it did little but make her breath come short for a few seconds. She straightened her back and frowned thoughtfully up at the lights.
"Are you going to be at this long?"
Folly asked.
"If so, I'm afraid I must decline to continue. I have an event I should attend."
It did seem fitting, after all, that one be present for one's own death, not out wandering about like a willful child shirking her chores. There was a moment of silence, and then the voice said,
"You are of one piece."
I hardly think you could have said anything more obvious,
Folly replied. She squinted, trying to peer through the mist.
Yet, you sought to control me, just as Madame Puppet is being directed, just as the silk weavers are being directed.
How can you know this?
The voice demanded.
I look at things and think about them,
Folly replied.
And use my intuition, of course, and deduction, and induction, as well as any historical or theoretical models that seem to apply. Also, I was having the most horrible dreams that were evidently supposed to go to Madame Puppet. What I can only assume were instructions of some sort. So I caught one in a web, and the master told me that it was an enemy sending, and that we had an enemy. And what he learned in the dream I caught led us to Habble Landing.
Folly felt her face split into a wide smile.
Ah, now I understand. You are the enemy.
If you cannot be made to serve,
said the enemy,
you will be unmade.
And the sandy soil suddenly began collapsing beneath Folly's feet. Folly's belly did little flips, and she began to scramble back, but it was fruitless. No matter how rapidly she retreated, the sand kept collapsing inward in a vast circle. She tried to run, and felt her steps slowing, bogged down in the granules, sloughing away beneath her feet. No matter how quickly she tried to move forward, she could feel herself being drawn back and down. Sand, Folly thought, was a terrifying substance. She could feel it rising up, covering her ankles, and her imagination treated her to an image of it filling up her nose, her mouth, her eyes. That would be a grim sort of death, smothering on tiny, tiny pieces of glass. No wonder the builders had surrounded humanity with Spirestone. Spirestone was quite wonderful, solid, reliable, durable. One always knew where one stood with Spirestone. No sooner had Folly completed the thought than her foot came down on something hard and flat. She blinked and looked down to see a block of dark rock supporting her foot and ankle beneath a steadily increasing torrent of sand.
Ah, obviously, Folly said aloud. My body is elsewhere. This is a place of the mind. In the mind, thoughts are the only reality.
She concentrated on the idea of Spirestone and took another step. To her considerable satisfaction, her foot came down upon another immovable block of black stone. The enemy let out a bellowing sound, like 100 deep, dissonant horns clamoring all at once, and Folly's heart leapt with terror. She began to run in earnest, and the Spirestone blocks became a regular staircase, rising up out of the collapsing sand. She bounded up the stairs as lightly as a cat, running against a current of sand that continued trying to push her back down. She reached the original ground level of the desert floor and continued running, her thoughts building more stairs ahead of her as she went. Behind her, there was another spine-wrenching, bellowing sound of rage, and the stairs beneath her feet shook as something utterly enormous took a great stride, and another, coming closer and closer. Folly did not dare look back, for fear that the sight of something terrible would shatter her concentration. She needed to escape. She fled up the staircase, trying to puzzle out how to leave this place. It seemed unfair that she should have reached it without any effort on her own part at all, only to be unable to leave. She returned to her previous reasoning. Thoughts were reality here. If one needed to leave a place, one went out through the door. She focused on the idea of a door, and suddenly it was there, above her, at the top of the stairs, set against a wall of nothing but empty air. Folly rushed up the last few stairs as glaring red light fell over her shoulders and changed the pale skin of her arms to scarlet. She hoped her theory was correct. Otherwise, she was about to hurl herself through an empty doorway and down several dozen yards into a vast collapsing pit of sand. Folly opened the door to see what looked like a cloud of fiery red sparks hovering in the air in front of her. The enemy bellowed again, and a terrible shadow fell over her, a darkness and a coldness like nothing she had ever experienced.
"Devour her!" bellowed the enemy. "Destroy her!"
Folly shrieked in involuntary fear and jumped through the open doorway into the empty air, slamming the door shut behind her. Folly sat up abruptly, clutching a batch of little lumen crystals in one hand, and blinked several times. Someone had her arms wrapped around her shoulders, and it turned out to be Bridget. There were also perhaps half a dozen of Predator's crew around her, including Benedict Sorrelin and the grim captain. They seemed exhausted and afraid, and they all brandished weapons in both hands. That seemed ominous. On the other hand, Folly's general sense of herself did not seem to be anything like what she imagined death would be, as an experience, which all things considered seemed a pleasant surprise. It was important to consider the good things along with the bad.
"Oh!" she said to her little crystals. "We did it! We escaped!"
Bridget jerked and stared at her. "Folly, are you all right?"
"Devour her," echoed the enemy's words in her mind. "Destroy her."
The enemy had been speaking to the campfire sparks, glimpsed through the doorway that had led from elsewhere. Sparks the same ruby color as the light of the enemy. Folly looked up to see dozens of silk weavers pouring into the tunnel, racing along the floor and walls and ceiling, their clustered eyes glinting with little scarlet pinpoints of light. And every single eye was focused upon Folly. The silk weavers let out a shriek in eerie unison, and then began to rush forward even faster. Chapter 55 Spire Albion, Havel Landing, Ventilation Tunnels. Bridget blinked as Folly opened her eyes, sat up and said gleefully,
"Oh, we did it! We escaped!"
Bridget looked blearily from the chaos in the remains of the Auroran camp to the wall of masonry that effectively trapped them in the side tunnel where she and Folly had been held prisoner. There was a small army of surface creatures preparing to devour them. The few men Captain Grimm had rallied to his side were wounded and tired, and they had no possible means of fleeing their foe. In what universe, she wondered dazedly, did their current predicament count as escape? Bridget shook herself from her thoughts and saw that the Etherealist's apprentice was staring blankly into space.
"Folly?"
Bridget asked.
"Folly, are you all right?"
"Miss Folly?" Benedict said, nodding down to the two girls.
He crouched down and peered at Folly, briefly putting a hand on her throat.
"She's breathing, and her heartbeat is strong. She doesn't seem to be injured. Perhaps she's taken a knock on the head."
"All things considered, I'm beginning to think that it would explain a great deal if we'd all taken a knock on the head,"
Bridget said.
"What are we going to do?"
"Fight,"
Benedict said with a grim smile for her joke. He drew a heavy knife from his belt, flipped it so that he held it by the blade, and offered its handle to Bridget.
"Here."
Bridget swallowed and took the knife. There was a reassuring heft to the blade in her hand, but she knew that if she needed to use the weapon, the silk weavers would be so close to her that it was unlikely to do her much good. More ominously, she saw that Benedict's hand and fingers were covered in his own blood, and that more of it had stained the knife's blade when he handed it to her. He was wounded, perhaps seriously. There were stains of an ugly color around the slices and gashes in his left forearm. Venom, doubtless. Silkweaver venom could be deadly, even to a warrior born. Bridget's heart sank a little, and she felt sick with sudden worry. But she swallowed, rose to stand beside Benedict, and said,
"Thank you, sir."
"I also saw this while we were coming here," Benedict said, and lifted his hand. He held Bridget's gauntlet. "I thought that so long as we were walking right past it, I might as well fetch it for you. Bridget let out a huff of breath that was not quite a laugh.
Most kind, sir, she said, and began strapping the gauntlet to her arm.
Her fingers did not fly with the speed and precision of a true expert, but they moved steadily and without hesitation.
Sir Sorrelin?
Miss Targwyn, Benedict said.
I suppose we are going to die here?
Bridget asked.
For goodness sake, I would ask that you be honest with me.
Benedict regarded her steadily for a moment. He said nothing. He didn't need to. She could see the answer in his eyes. Bridget continued strapping on her gauntlet, surprised at how calm she felt. It wasn't that the prospect of a violent death didn't frighten her. Indeed, she felt terrified. But simultaneously, she had chosen to be here. She stood in harm's way because she had elected to do so, to risk danger so that others could be protected. Whatever else happened this day, she knew that she had already drawn a great deal of the attention of horrible creatures and the monsters that served them away from innocence and onto herself. She had served as a shield and sword to her fellow Albions. She didn't want to end her life that day, far from it. But all lives ended. If today was to be her last, she would have it be an ending with meaning. Surely dying in battle against such hideous foes spoke with absolute eloquence regarding her choices and her life. Outside the tunnel, the sound of skittering and chittering grew louder.
"Here they come,"
said one of the aeronauts, his voice tight with fear.
"Steady," said Captain Grimm.
From the excitement in his voice, he might have been talking about the weather. Bridget glanced aside at the captain. He stood with his bloodied sword in hand, his still-hot gauntlet sending up wisps of smoke where copper cagework touched heavy leather bracer. His face was pale but calm, his eyes fixed on the entrance of the tunnel. Her gaze continued to Benedict Sorrelin, tall and straight, his breath coming a little harder than it had been a few moments before. That had to be the work of the poison. He too faced the darkness with a calm, pale face. He bounced his sword a few times in his hand, seemingly unaware that he moved the heavy steel weapon as if it had been no weightier than a cloth napkin. If the nature of her foes would speak to the credit of Bridget's death, then surely the nature of her allies would speak even more loudly and clearly of her life. She finished the last buckle on her gauntlet, primed it, gripped the heavy knife in her right hand, and turned to face the foe beside Benedict. Folly suddenly drew in a sharp breath, and her eyes went wide and round. She stared for a second at the tunnel's entrance and then lifted her hands, making small whimpering sounds, scrambling away from the entrance until her back was pressed against the makeshift masonry wall. Bridget stared at her for a second, and then remembered in a flash Folly's precognitive reaction just before the horde of infant silk weavers had come plunging out of the ceiling. She tracked the direction of Folly's gaze and whirled to shout to Grimm,
"The ceiling, Captain! Fire!"
Grimm stared at her for half a second, but Bridget did not wait to see what the man would do. She raised her gauntlet and sent a howling bolt of energy flashing up toward the ceiling of the tunnel at its entrance. Even as she did, the first of a horde of silk weavers poured forward, rushing along the ceiling. Bridget's blast missed, but Grimm's shot, coming half a second later, neatly speared the lead silk weaver on a shaft of blazing light and sent it tumbling to the floor. The silk weavers came on then, horrible and terrifyingly swift, flowing like a living carpet over the ceiling of the tunnel toward them. Their eyes gleamed. Their tripartite jaws gaped, and they were emitting a chorus of hissing, whistling shrieks.
"Ceiling!"
Grimm shouted, even as he loosed more blasts.
"Fire! Fire! Fire!"
The aeronauts and Benedict followed suit, and for a moment the silk weavers were torn and blasted from the ceiling almost as quickly as they appeared. Bridget had no idea whether she hit anything, though it seemed fair to note that she could hardly have missed every blast. It was, she thought, more like pumping water at a fire than any kind of battle she had ever heard about. Unfortunately, their pumps had a very limited amount of pressure. The aeronaut's gauntlets began overheating one by one, searing leather and the flesh beneath. Grim was the last of his men to stop shooting, and the copper cagework around his gauntlet was glowing red-hot in places before he was through, leaving Bridget to keep firing at targets alone, her own weapon fresher and holding less waste heat than the weapons that had been engaged in lengthy battle already.
"Blades!"
Grim called, as the tide of silk weavers began surging forward now, confident and aggressive. Sheaths rattled and steel whispered as the aeronauts drew their weapons. The first silk weaver leapt down upon them, only to be met by a group of swords and stabbed repeatedly. But Bridget could see what would inevitably happen, and her eyes blurred with tears of frustration as she watched more silk weavers pour in. There weren't anywhere near as many of them as there had been only a short while before, perhaps only a dozen, but they outnumbered the Albions 2-1, and a man was a far more fragile creature than a silk weaver. They had come maddeningly close to victory, but now it was only a matter of time until death found them. The silk weavers began to spring down upon the besieged little band. And then Bridget heard the most beautiful music of her entire life. When a single cat let loose a war cry, it was an unsettling sound. When two cats suddenly wailed at each other in a similar fashion, it was downright unnerving. When hundreds of them caterwauled at the same time, in a single voice, the sound alone was enough to make one feel as if the skin had been peeled from one's muscle and bone, to call up horrors inherited from ancestors long since dead and forgotten, raw terror before a deadly predator. Not even the alien implacability of the silk weavers could ignore that call, and the surface creatures began to skitter and dart nervously back and forth. Raoul and the Nine Claws had come to wage war. Cats flashed into the tunnel in a howling wave, led by Raoul, son of Maul of the Silent Paws. At his side rushed Norn, chief of the Nine Claws, and a cadre of the tribe's largest warriors flanked them, every single one of them wearing a set of battle spurs. The tight mass of cats seemed to explode all at once in different directions. Those who had never seen a tribe of cats at war, or at least playing war games, would look upon what came next as utter chaos. Cats dashed this way and that, seemingly at random, scratching with their claws, leaping, biting, and accomplishing nothing. But Bridget knew better. The cats knew they were no match for the much larger and stronger silk weavers on an individual basis. Rather than sacrifice their warriors in desperate slashing piles of pure attrition, they played a different game, forcing the silk weavers to react to them, to keep them continuously spinning and turning and snapping at threats, only to have the cats they targeted sprint away before they could be pinned down. Cats darted this way and that, always passing a whisker's breadth out of reach of the silk weavers. The surface creatures, furious and agitated, could only snap uselessly at the air where a rushing cat had been, and try to keep track of every movement. And then, once fatigue had begun to slow the silk weavers, once confusion had reduced the fantastic speed of their reflexes, Raoul and Norn struck. Bridget watched as her friend suddenly sprinted directly at a silk weaver's open jaws. She began to shout a warning, but Raoul bounded left and right and then flung himself down flat on his back without ever slowing down. The cat slid beneath the silk weaver and promptly began raking with his battle spurs. Raoul let out another war howl, and his rear legs blurred as he raked and raked at the underbelly of the silk weaver above him. He rolled and sprinted out an instant before a rush of stinking purplish fluid and some kind of mucus burst from the silk weaver's abdomen. The silk weaver thrashed madly for a few seconds and then tottered onto its side, its many legs weaving uselessly and only slowly becoming still.
"Raoul!"
Bridget called delightedly.
Little mouse,
Raoul caroled merrily in reply.
Do not kill any of my prey. I have a wager with Non.
The cat bounded aside from the attack of a silk weaver Bridget would have sworn Raoul could not have seen, and rushed away, only to slide beneath another lethally harassed silk weaver on the opposite side of the tunnel. Once again he raked madly and darted clear before he could be drenched in the stinking guts of his foe. Captain Grimm surged forward with his sword held high, bellowing,
"Help the cats! Bait the silk weavers! Wear them out!"
Benedict darted forward to slash at a silkweaver who had managed to seize a cat's tail, menacing the creature and forcing it to release the cat, then kicked another silkweaver away from a wounded cat, leaping to place himself between the surface creature and the downed feline, his teeth bared in a wide grin. Bridget held back. Given her skill with a gauntlet, it would have been foolishness to start hurling bolts of energy into that kind of chaos. Given how short her knife was, employing it seemed to her an excellent way to be poisoned by the silk weavers, and besides, someone had to stand watch over Folly to make sure one of the spiteful things didn't rush her helpless form. The battle did not last long. Just as the silk weavers had outnumbered the Albions, leading to only one inevitable conclusion, the cats outnumbered the silk weavers to much the same effect. Norn, Raoul, and Norn's personal guard dispatched the creatures as each presented itself as a target, until only one silk weaver remained standing. And at that point, Norn let out a vicious, furious howl, and 200 nine-claws threw themselves upon the beast, ripping and tearing in a frenzy of wrath. The cats didn't kill the silk weaver so much as they spread it evenly over several dozen square yards of tunnel. Bridget almost felt sorry for the beast. Not quite, but almost.
"Bugger me!"
blurted a burly aeronaut. Bridget thought his name was Kettle, or Keppel, or something like that.
"Little furry bastards don't play around, do they?"
"Mind your tongue, Kettle,"
Captain Grimm said. "All things considered, I think it very wise not to deliver any unintentional insults, hm?"
"I skip,"
Kettle said, eyeing the spreading stain that had been a silk weaver a few moments before.
"That does seem like good sense. No offense intended, kitties."
Raoul sauntered lazily up to Little Mouse, looking enormously pleased with himself.
"Five,"
he said smugly.
"Five full-grown silk weavers in as many minutes. Maul has never done that."
Bridget tried to speak and found that she couldn't. Instead, she dropped her knife, let out a little choking sound, and scooped Raoul up in her arms, hugging his furry warmth close to her.
"You've saved us," she said.
"Of course I did," Raoul responded. "I am without flaw."
Bridget swallowed hard, and then she did begin to cry.
"I was so scared," she said. "I thought I was going to die a long way from home."
Raoul made a deep, pleased purring sound in his chest.
"How could that happen?"
he asked.
"When you have me to protect you."
She choked out a laugh.
"You are impossible."
"I am Cat,"
Raoul said smugly.
"It is not of your doing, Little Mouse.
It is natural that something so limited as a human finds me impossible.
And you are squishing my fur."
Bridget kissed the top of Raoul's furry head, hugged him once more, and set him down on the floor. Oddly, he did not seem at all concerned about his fur.
"I would speak to Grim Ship Trees."
Bridget blinked.
"You have given him a name."
Raoul shook his ears as if he hadn't heard her, and yawned.
"Will you speak Albion to him for me?"
"I will," Bridget said. "Benedict, stay with Folly."
"Of course," Benedict said. He nodded rather deeply to Raoul and said,
Well fought.
He knows, Bridget said, before Raoul could actually utter an answer. Raoul seemed to consider it for a moment, then turned with a flick of his tail that indicated the same disinterest as a human shrug.
Yes, he said, I do. Come, little mouse.
Bridget accompanied Raoul over to Captain Grimm.
Master Raoul,
Grimm greeted the cat gravely.
He straightened, tucked his hat beneath one arm, and swept a very low bow to Raoul.
You have preserved my life and the lives of my men. I'm in your debt.
I know that,
Raoul said, through Bridget.
I have a mission to complete as a member of the Spyrarch's warriors. There are still Auroran warriors loose in the territory of the Nine Claws. The Nine Claws and I have saved your lives. Now you must help them defend their territory.
Aye, Grimm said, nodding.
He glanced aside and his eyes widened. Bridget looked up to see the rest of the crew of Predator emerging from one of the other shadowy tunnels. The broken forms of several silkweavers dotted the floor behind them, as did motionless human forms. Evidently, the larger group of men had been kept bottled up in their tunnel by a relatively small number of silkweavers. Now they emerged, gauntlets primed, swords in hand, staring warily at the cats.
Hold your fire! Grimm shouted. Stand down. It's over. The cats are with us.
The men obeyed their captain, and Grimm turned back to Bridget and Raoul.
Whatever the Aurorans put those marines here to do, they're off to do it. They must be stopped. Will the Nine Claws help?
Raoul's tail flicked left and right.
The Nine Claws do not care which humans rule the human portion of the Havel. Their war was with the Silkweavers. Fighting surface creatures is one thing. Fighting humans with gauntlets is another.
Grimm grunted. What about intelligence? Can they tell us where the Aurorans are?
Instead of answering, Raoul sat down, and a heartbeat later a little bit of shadow detached itself from a wall and padded over to sit next to him. Raoul's 30-pound frame dwarfed that of the smaller female cat who sat down beside him, though she showed not an ounce less dignity.
"Hello, Myrl," Bridget said. "Captain Grimm, this is Myrl."
"I am pleased to know her name," Grimm said. "Thank you, Myrl, for your warning. Do you know where the Aurorans have gone?"
"Of course,"
Myrl said, with a sidelong glance at Raoul.
"While you spoiled children have been amusing yourselves killing prey that is not even good for food, I was doing the important work."
"What work is that, please?"
Grimm asked.
"Following the Aurorans, of course,"
Myrl said.
"Incidentally, I did so entirely without getting anyone who depended upon me captured by the enemy."
Raoul's eyes narrowed slightly.
"Out with it," he growled. "Where are they?"
Instead of answering, Myrl licked a paw fastidiously, for just long enough to make it clear that Raoul was not compelling her to do anything she did not wish to do.
Bridget sighed. Cats.
She held up a hand for silence when Captain Grimm began to ask a question. He frowned, but complied. After a moment, Myrl spoke.
"They are in the stone house, with walls and dirt and green-growing things."
Benedict stiffened.
"The temple? What are they doing there?"
"Killing,"
Myrl answered.
"Burning."
Bridget's gaze shot to Captain Grimm.
"Why would they do that?"
"Why, indeed," Grimm replied, his eyes narrowing. "We must help them, Captain," Benedict said fervently.
Grimm studied the young man for a moment before nodding.
"We'll do all we can. Creedy, I know everyone is exhausted, but we're moving out."
Chapter 56 Spire Albion, Havel Landing, Temple of the Way. Raoul, having defeated the army of silkweavers, virtually unassisted, sat and watched as the humans floundered about in the wake of the battle. Little Mouse,